The following talk was given by Jed Larson at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 21, 2026. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Great to see everybody here. I always enjoy the winter sessions. Just have a particular silence to them. The sun can stream in through the windows and nice bright. I was happy to get the snow back. Like all the snow was gone and then it all came back. Hopefully not causing too many driving problems for people, but for my two session talks, I was going to cover a piece, a work by Dogen Zenji. Dogen, I think a lot of you know who that is. It's a 13th century Zen master from Japan. And this is his probably most commonly known work, the Shobo Genzo, the Full Shobo Genzo, which is about 100, they're called fascicles, essentially essays of different length. And last session I talked on the fascicle on the Heart Sutra, which is, the second fascicle. And I'll be looking at the third one, the Genjo Koan, this time. It's a pretty short piece, actually. It's only about 4 pages here, but it's considered one of his most famous works. So I'm thinking maybe some of you are familiar with it already. Apparently this was originally meant to be the very first fascicle. I'm not sure why it got pushed back a little bit here, but it's at the very beginning of the collection, essentially. And Dogen wrote this piece having just come back from China, so he had received his endorsement to teach from Ru Jing in China. When he got back, I think there's a few years where he was practicing on his own, and then not too long after that, he founded a monastery just south of Kyoto, a monastery called Kosho Monastery. Actually had a couple names, I think, but Dogen was born in, I think, 1200, if I got that date right. He established his monastery at 1233, so at the age of 33. And Genjo Koan took about a month to write, which is a pretty short amount of time considering how timeless it is. It's something that's quoted over and over in Zen teachings. So he wrote it around the time of this founding of that original monastery, and apparently he revised it 19 years later too, so I think he tended to work on his writings over time, making small adjustments.
Do you know how old he was when he passed away?
I think he was around 50, something like that.
Yeah.
Was it exactly 50 or?
No, I don't know. 52 is
what I had in mind. Yeah, I think that's about right. So pretty young, although I don't know what's the average lifespan in 13th century Japan. Probably older than 50, but yeah, it seems a little young. He died of an illness, so. And the main theme of Genjo Koan is something that I pick up in so many different fascicles of the Shobo Genzo. I think it, just like many writings of Dogen, they have a particular resonance to session, I think, for me, in the sense that when you read Dogen, it has this quality of, it can be frustrating because some of it's sort of contradictory sounding and mysterious, but I think when you can just read it sort of like poetry, have this effect of sort of softening our ideas a little bit. So I think there's this similar resonance that session can also be frustrating in some ways, but then there can also be this quality of softening as we are kind with ourselves and we're just sitting here, we're supporting each other, we're taking care of our practice. So there can be a nice warm feeling to all that as well. And then a softening of our ideas. So that main theme that comes out in Ganjo Koan, and I see it in many different writings, is Dogen's emphasis on how we may look for something very specific. It could be the different things that we're looking for in life. You know, we're identifying different things that we want or that we're drawn to, that we want to push away, or even sort of more lofty ideas about how we may want to attain something or we're interested in enlightenment. Actually, I'm not sure how many people like say, I want enlightenment. It's normally like it has a different name to it, kind of like realization, or you sort of have an image of something a little different somehow. You know, how do I place myself kind of in a different spot? But Dogen has a particular way of speaking of this. And the translation of Genjo Koan is actualizing the fundamental point. And one line from Genjo Koan here is, when you see forms or hear sound, fully engaging body and mind, you intuit Dharma intimately. And that's the theme that I feel is so often present in Dogen, is that he's talking about hearing sounds, seeing forms. So he'll often talk about tiles and pebbles, fences, that this is the this sound, this hearing or seeing is actually the manifestation of this fundamental point, or it's the realization of totality, even in just the things that we would normally think of as very mundane. So also a resonance with session as we are here and we hear these teachings of Zen, which are always getting us back to this very earthy quality of we're actually in a room, you know. We're doing walking meditation in the sensation of the wood underneath our feet. So Dogen is, you know, trying to guide our attention to that sort of the undeniable, but then also saying that when we have ideas about whatever the sensation is, we're probably not, you know, the experience is of a thought then at that moment. So he's always getting us back to the truth of reality and relative reality being inseparable. So I'll go ahead and start. I'll read the intro here. Dogen writes, as all things are Buddha Dharma, there is delusion, realization, practice, birth and death, Buddhas and sentient beings. As myriad things, all things, are without an abiding self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient beings, no birth and death. So here we have what seems like two separate parts, the there is and there is no. So there is delusion, realization, and then also he's saying that there's no delusion, no realization, And particularly that second part, the without part, sort of maybe throws us off a little bit. And we hear about that teaching, no abiding self in Buddhism. But I think Dogen is saying that whatever experience shows up, the myriad things, however they're showing up, it's like light is undeniable, but we try to grasp light. It just doesn't make sense, even though yet light is right here. So Dogen's reminding us that while we may be kind of disoriented a little bit when we see these two things that seem contradictory, actually, in experience itself, we find that it's not actually contradictory. So these things are showing up. He says all things are Buddha Dhamma, so there is the showing up of delusion and realization. But we can't lose sight of the understanding that there's no permanence to anything that we may encounter. So there is light, yet we cannot grasp that. It's ungraspable, but undeniably here and now, this experience. And Dogen, and by the way, I won't be reading through everything. It's I'll kind of excerpt different things out of here because it's so such a dense teaching. And Buddha goes, Dogen goes on to say right after that, the Buddha way in essence is leaping clear of abundance and lack. And here, again, as we hear Dogen say, there is realization and delusion. And then he also says there's no realization, no delusion. He says that the Buddha way is leaping clear of abundance and lack. So if we hear Dogen saying that there is and there isn't, and we take that very literally, that's not what he's trying to convey to us. He says that actually the Buddha way is to leap clear of this teaching as like contradictory or something to be taken literally. The Buddha way is leaping clear of that. And in doing so, we can understand that this is not actually contradictory. We can have things show up just as they are, but not insist that they need to be permanent things. Experience of things can be exactly as they are without any description. So we'll also hear the teaching of the anatta doctrine, or not self. And I think in some ways we can talk about the anatta doctrine in a very similar way, in that it's saying not self, but not no self. And those are, you know, I mean, in some ways those are, like, okay, that's the two options. What's left then? That's all the options. But I think that's the whole point. The anatta doctrine, or emptiness, shunyata, is an exceedingly subtle teaching where, you know, we hear those not self, but not no self. And we think, well, those are the two options, but that's precisely what we're doing. We're setting down any ideas or options. You know, that's basically what the practice is. Insisting that it be one or the other. So the anatta doctrine is this pointing to reality and giving us a clue that, of course, we can't describe it in any way that's absolutely true. but it's definitely frustrating. As I say, Dogen's writing can be kind of it can be transfixing, but then it also can be frustrating at times. But I think it's frustrating almost in the same way that if we were to think of a flower and we were to insist that an idea conveys the aroma of the flower, of course that's going to be frustrating to us, you know, if we're insisting on that idea. And I think it's basically the same type of frustration that arises with Dogen, because these things that don't really work in reality, they seem contradictory, so they don't make sense. But basically, we're trying to insist that, you know, a single line here is going to give us a complete explanation of reality, and it'll always be frustrating. So if we can sort of just let the words soften our understanding, I think that's one of the main benefits of reading Dogen. So, of course, just smelling the flower is very direct. It's just simply happening. It's unrelated to any idea, even of self, of other, or how aroma works or anything. It's just experience. And Dogen goes on and says, in response to that, those first few lines, let's see here. Yet, amidst our attachment, blossoms fall, and amidst our aversion, weeds spread. And actually, being human is a very fortunate situation in relation to this. He's saying that even though we have attachments, blossoms fall. Even though we have aversion, weeds spread, so we don't want the weeds to come. We're averse to them, but they spread. It's actually a very fortunate situation to be in this predicament, basically, that even though we want things to stay, the blossoms fall. Because we awaken right in the middle of that aversion, right in the middle of that attachment. We recognize precisely what's happening. And again, we see the parallel in Sesshin, where we're really, task is to really pay attention to what's going on. And in doing so, we can see thinking arising and ceasing. We can notice the light coming in through the windows or sound, whatever it might be. So we awaken. This awakening is right together with whatever it might be that's happening. I think of it, this fortunate situation to be in a situation where aversion or attachment is happening. It's kind of like being in the woods and being lost. I don't know if you've ever had this situation where you're lost and then you see something that you, oh, I completely recognize that thing, and then everything's cleared up. Just because you notice a landmark or something like that, you see it from another direction or something like that, and everything, you know, just clears up instantly. So that's the same fortunate situation of being a human being and sitting in meditation and everything seems to be going wrong. But what this practice is just to recognize the immediacy of whatever that is. It's not to get rid of what seems like a situation that's not ideal. You know, we may think that a calm mind is sort of what we want, but this is exactly where awakening occurs, right here now. Yeah, Andrew.
There was one time a couple of years ago, Andy and I were hiking around Dunklin, and we were picking wild blueberries. We do that every year. And we went off in a totally different place. And this was like after the big fire went through.
Mm.
And so years after the fire went through, and so things were growing really tall.
Yeah,
so
pretty brushy.
So the place that we normally picked, which is covered in this huge, growth.
Yeah.
We got completely lost.
Oh, yeah.
And
everything's the same, kind of.
Yeah. Everything looked completely different from what we were used to.
Mm.
And I could feel that happening where it's like, first there was a little bit of panic.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, I don't know where I am. And then, the Bible will bring up all the stories about bears.
Bears who like blueberries.
Yes.
In which you have a full basket of
blueberries, especially the big basket I have right here. But, there was that one point where you're like, well, okay, this is happening. I'm just going to try to, work with what's happening. I saw one thing, like, that rock.
Mm.
I saw that rock.
Yeah.
And from that point, we were able to find our way back to our car.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was very interesting to see all that coming up,
Well, that's funny. That feeling of just like disorientation exactly. How long am I going to be out here? Like, am I going to be sleeping outside? That's a little spooky. But even, in this discontent, or because of the discontent, we'll sort of want, our mind will go towards something. We want, say, non-duality or something. That seems like a solution for us. And all along, we're not recognizing what Zen is always pointing us to is this vivid experience, which, of course, is just like complete contrast in variety. So, we got this idea of non-dual understanding, which basically would be like to sweep away all the incalculable variety that shows up in our life. So it's sort of funny how we can sort of see something or have an idea of something and it seems really enticing. And in doing that, we're basically distracted from this great variety that's happening. When it snowed a couple days ago, just this last one and the prior one too, where everything just becomes completely white and then it's a clear sky and you go outside and it's just like so bright. It's this wonderful just brilliance of light coming from every single angle. Yet it could be like completely freezing out. So it's this grand, just sort of vibrating experience that has both like the difficulty of extreme cold and then also this brilliance, warmth of the sun and everything that the sun gives us. So we're fortunate to awaken right in the middle of this variety. And of course, being in this variety very naturally, we'll want the weeds to go away. We'll want the blossoms to stay. But that's right where we practice. This is about understanding completely what it is to be human, and which sort of reminds you of the Buddha's original quest. He saw the discontent, suffering in human life, and that's exactly what he set out to do. He didn't set out to, like, I have this idea of non-dual understanding or, some kind of like personal bubble of peace and bliss or something like that. He went out and he discovered the depth of what it is to be human and what suffering, this cause of suffering is. And Dogen goes on and says, To carry the self forward and illuminate myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and illuminate the self is awakening. So carry the self forward is delusion. To allow myriad things to come forth and illuminate the self is awakening. For some reason, I had this memory come up for me of, you know, when you're watching TV and you're kind of just clicking through the channels, and then all of a sudden this reality show showed up, and it was the somebody who was in the reality show, and the producer or whatever is interviewing this person, and the person says, I'm not sure why I remember this because it's so absurd, but he said, I can really tend to command respect from people. Which is like, okay, that's pretty egoistic. Whoever says something like that. I mean, if you command respect from people, it's just like, it's going to happen. But I thought, what a poor guy, you know, he's just being prodded by this producer to say something ridiculous. But it just kind of makes me think of all the different ways that we go forward. You know, we are bringing ourselves to the world, and the world is sort of there for us. You know, we're there, and we're going to get kind of what we want from it. We're going to sort of posture ourselves in a certain situation in order to get what we want. I think that's kind of what Dogen is saying here. To carry the self forward, delusion, essentially. So it's kind of like when we take a little bit of a closer look at that, you know, what's going on there exactly? Why are we really interested in that? And that's what the practice is, to keep taking a look at all the little ways that we are carrying forward and see something a little bit different. I thought of another example of this, what would you say, pretty confident type of perspective of ego. It was a interaction between Lucy and Charlie Brown. And I get the quote right here. Lucy says to Charlie, look, Charlie, let's face it. We all know that I'm the one who's in charge here. So it's like, it's very enticing for us to kind of find that position where we're the one in charge. We're going to go out. We're going to illuminate things. And then Dogen goes on and says, and this one is a little strange sounding. It says, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. So it's another example of how Dogen's writing catches us off guard a little bit, which I think helps. Because if a teaching comes across and it just has a very literal quality to it and we're just completely agreeing with everything, we may not notice how we're just basically formulating an idea or like a philosophy about life. Because I think a lot of Buddhist teachings are sort of undeniable in their, at least for me, it's kind of like, okay, this really makes sense. That, you know, we pay attention to reality, to live life fully. But if we just kind of come up with a creed for ourselves and not actually be sincere about the practice, we'll kind of get off track a little bit. But so here Dogen often says things that are a little strange. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. And an image of, like, if you were to draw a tree on a piece of paper and then show it to somebody and ask what it is, they would say tree probably. But then you could also say it's not actually a tree, it's a piece of paper. I mean, you could say so many different things. You know, it's the graphite on paper or whatever else, sort of go down the trail there. But it's an interesting thing to think about, just how quickly we go to the concept or go to the representation and sort of say that's what it is. Of course, we don't think it's a real tree, but it's just a very quick movement towards the sort of symbology of that, the language, and how often we really were sort of really in that perspective of the definitions, the framing up of the world. But here, Dogen's saying that Buddhas don't necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. So that, I think, is saying that the mind of the awakened don't have that quick preoccupation with thinking about what's what, defining something as one way or another. For the awakened mind, awakening is what's undeniable and what's true. So even ideas that may be arising for us, I think for the awakened mind, they're almost like guests. It's so easy to associate with our ideas. So often we don't even kind of notice the idea. It's just quickly to the reaction based on the idea. It's, it can be my idea of something, and then the preference happens, and then we sort of speak or take action according to kind of that energy. So here, the idea is kind of like the guest who's coming through. It's not, there's another quote by the Buddha, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not my thought. I think we kind of see that here with this, the type of understanding where we don't quickly go to the preoccupation with thinking. And Dogen finishes that line. He says, however they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddha. So he's saying that there is awakening. There's this actualization. It's interesting, that line there reminded me of the translation of Genjo Koan. This book, and I should also mention, this is the version that's edited by Ta-Nehisi. So Ta-Nehisi was kind of the lead editor, but then also the guiding person for reviewing all the different translations that a bunch of different people did. So I think it was maybe Mel Weitzman for this particular piece. So somebody else would do the translation, and then they would work together with Ta-Nehisi to sort of work out the details. The other main translation that we use is by Nishijima and Cross. So if you're looking for Shobo Genzo, Nishijima on one side and then Ta-Nehisi, those are, I think, what the most often translations that we go to.
Is the Nishijima one, is that 4 or 5 books?
Yeah, exactly. So you'll see it as 4 volumes. And then just as a side note, you can find all 4 volumes. The original author and translator has posted all those online, so you can check out any of that for free. It's all legit.
Is there a copy of this one in the library?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. We'll go back and forth between the two often. I liked this translation for this piece. And let's see, the translation of Genjo Koan here is actualizing the fundamental point. So if I think of, what that feels like to me, actualizing the fundamental point seems to have like a flavor of experience. And then the other translation series translates it as the realized universe, which has a different flavor to me. You know, it's more, it's almost like the experience that occurs, and then also just the experience. That makes sense. So actualizing the fundamental point versus the realized universe. It's I was just in the Grand Canyon about a week ago, and it struck me that we use that term experience in similar ways. That we'll talk about it as I had a certain experience, like I experienced the Grand Canyon, but then we'll also say that we'll talk about it as a noun, basically the experience of the Grand Canyon, just in a very general way, like you're talking about. So like the realized universe has a kind of that feel to it, that the experience or basically reality. But then also you have experience as actualizing this fundamental point, which has more of kind of an intimate feel to it. And I think that's helpful too when we look at the two different, two different translations, we'll get these two different dynamics that seem like they're completely different. In other words, experience and reality, those seem like different things. But I think Dogen is actually helping us sort of, again, soften that. And we're not talking about, like, an experience of a particular person here, but just experience itself and just reality itself is not necessarily two distinct things like we would normally think of them. So that's the beauty of Dogen helping us loosen our ideas of what relative reality is, what ultimate reality is. Let's see here. All right, in the next section, and I mentioned this line at the beginning. He says, when you see forms or hear sounds, fully engaging body and mind, you intuit Dharma intimately. Then he says, unlike things and their reflections in the mirror, and unlike the moon and its reflection in the water, when one side is illumined, the other side is dark. And we have some imagery here. So he's saying, unlike the moon and the reflection in the water. So often the moon is a representation of enlightenment. And then the reflection in water can be seen as the relative world. So in all things, we have this reflection of enlightenment. So whatever is encountered, so to speak, is full representation of the moon or enlightenment. So not enlightenment out there, and then the relative muddy world here, and we're trying to get somewhere else. Dogen's always bringing us back to this water in which the moon is fully and perfectly reflected. But the beauty of Dogen, he's putting that there. He's talking about the reflection of the moon in the water. But he says, unlike that, when one side is illumined, the other side is dark. So, let's see. I had an example for this. I'll just continue on with my notes here. So he says, um, again, truth beyond concept is beyond concepts is always speaking. So we see the speaking of, again, as I was saying, speaking of truth in no matter what is encountered. And if we try to understand truth in solely a relative way, we'll become frustrated. But he says, well, if one side is illumined, the other side is dark. He's reminding us that if we have some sort of lofty view then of what the moon is, or sort of the perfection of the relative world, he's bringing us right back to this, bringing us back to Earth, basically, and saying that, of course, when one side is illumined, the other side is dark. So it's, with a lofty view, then we may lose track of how we have this quality of one side dark, one side illumined. That's how reality shows up. So we can't deny how a warm day can be a warm day and a cool day can be a cool day. But then also in the fall, we have a warm 60-degree day, or excuse me, a cool 60-degree day, because we're coming out of the summer. And in the spring, we have a very warm 60-degree day. But we deny in that moment, when we feel this as a warm 60-degree day in the spring, it has an undeniable aspect to our preference that's coming up there. Yet we can't freeze that, in an absolute description of what's happening. It just never works. So Dogen's helping us see that this light and shadow is always part of experience. Again, that phrase that I mentioned at the very opening, fully engaging in body and mind, you intuit Dharma intimately. He uses the term body and mind, and in this translation, they actually hyphenate those three words. So there's a hyphen between body and mind, two hyphens there, which I think is helpful. There's, from a relative point of view, there's a lot of different ways of seeing how body and mind, we like separate things out basically. Body and mind, I've reflected on different pain that can come up during meditation, and it seems like there's almost not like a verbal commentary that comes up with pain. It's just like a instantaneous aversion to it. So it's like not a dialogue that I don't like this pain. It's just kind of like, that's almost the same thing as if you're sitting in a chair and you just cross your legs. It's just like a little preference that we do to sort of move a little bit, because, which is, fine. It's, and pain comes up, it's totally natural to be not liking it. But it's interesting to think that it's almost like a thinking of the body, where it's not like a verbal thinking, this preference of not wanting pain. At least that's what I've sort of noticed for myself when I maybe are making more continual adjustments to try to get away from the pain, even though there's not like a verbal commentary going on, to notice that that this is thinking as well. And that's fine, because there's a preference going on there. So in that way, what we think of as the brain thinking about whether we like something or not is not probably so different than how the body likes things or doesn't like it, even though it's not. I think I've heard the same thing for animals. I think they kind of suppose that, say, a dog who's really attracted to food, they don't have a lingual type of system to create that preference. It's more like symbols for them, or areas of the brain that sort of light up in the same way that concepts do. So all this to say that this body and mind, where the translator brings that together, we can see that experience of thinking and preferences can show up in a lot of different ways, including ways that don't really seem like they fit into our defined sense of thinking and preferences. That this is kind of going on in very subtle ways. And that's a big thing about sitting in meditation, is to actually see the quiet nature of how preferences can be kind of happening. Not to analyze them or label them, but just to notice that, to see experience face to face, and just to come back to the breath. When we notice, we're always coming back to the breath and staying here. And also this body and mind term, I think, also reflects Dogen's ability to talk about body and mind in a more expansive way, so beyond our sense of what we think of as self. It's, again, a reflection of ultimate reality. And then we come across a quote here that's referenced pretty often. Dogen says, "To study the way of enlightenment is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self." And in Buddhism, we see that our Buddhism, the Buddha Dharma, is consistently bringing our attention back to how self is very central to everything that we do. It's the basis in which we think and speak and act. So the suggestion is to continually look at what this is. Dogen is saying, to study the way of enlightenment is to study the self, or to stay here, whatever activity that seems to be coming up, whatever it might be, a feeling, a thought. So we look, we continue to look, so the writing here has that reverberation of what session is to just looking. And in looking, we don't find anything convincing about what's coming up in terms of our ideas. That's something that becomes evident in light of the self-evident nature of experience itself. So thinking, it was arising and ceasing. As we continue to sit, that convincing quality of ideas can just naturally drop away, because it, in light again of experience itself, becomes much less convincing. So the sitting practice is to really open that door to see thinking, to be there with it. And not necessarily try to push it away or just try to say that it's not convincing, but when we dedicate to really staying here and seeing face to face the ideas, then we can just see what they are, exactly what they are, and know that they're our friends. You know, we use thinking. It's almost like, in some ways, the interpretation of Buddhism is that things or thinking gets a bad rap. You know, it's like delusion and so forth gets attributed to ideas. But the practice is allowing us to really appreciate thinking and in some ways not abuse thinking. You know, so it's doing us a lot of favors in our life, because we need to work out different things and plan. We need to, maybe think about what happened last week where we said something to somebody and we realize, yeah, maybe I should go back and apologize for that. You know, that's part of how thinking works. In sitting, we see thinking straightforwardly, and we're not fooled by what this is. We don't jump right to that speech or action based on the preference. So it's seeing, thinking, and giving it the respect that it deserves. So studying the way of enlightenment is to study the self. So it seems like we're staying here, we're watching whatever is coming up. And it may seem like I'm watching my thoughts come up, or there's, you know, just kind of a maybe general idea of what it means to watch the self, but Dogen is saying that the self, studying the self is actually true self. That's what actually is happening. We think it's me, my thoughts, and so forth. And as we sit down and dedicate to this practice, what is actually happening is the true self, not a confined, narrow self that we sort of often, that's sort of our starting point for trying to understand things, but actually that's not the full picture. Let's see here. Dogen also talks about, says, to forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, the body and mind, as well as the body of minds of others, drop away. Then he says, no trace of enlightenment remains. And this no trace continues endlessly. So no trace of enlightenment remains. If we look for the past or the future, maybe traces or sources, different things like that, if we continue to look at that, if we look for those things, what we find is an idea. And again, it's useful to kind of recognize the different qualities. I mean, we can think of the past as sort of like a specific thing, you know, like George Washington or something like that. Or we can think of it as a memory. And both of those are very helpful ways. They're very different ways. You know, we have no memory of George Washington. So there's different kind of, I would say, almost, they have an amusing or vibrant quality to it, you know, that you can think about the relative world in different ways. Same thing with the future. But ultimately, here in practice, we're really settling in to seeing the real kind of core quality of what this is, and those things are ideas, to understand what that is and not be fooled by it. So we don't find any beginning that's convincing as a real thing. So Dogen is saying that no trace of enlightenment remains. Enlightenment is not coming from somewhere, you know, leaving kind of like a trail to it or something like that. And Dogen says this trace continues endlessly. So there's an undeniable quality of tracelessness. It's reality completely expounding itself as here now. There's no truth in thinking about it as of here now is really having anything to do with past and present. Actually, here now is this full manifestation, includes past and present and future. And then here, saying that you may recognize this, or this is a sort of famous phrase or section. There's so many ones that are often quoted here. And as I was reading through it for the first, it does have kind of like an episodic feel to it. And they actually separate this with horizontal lines, so each one of these kind of has its own mini essay type of feel to it. I'll read through this next one just to get us up to speed on it. He says, Dogen says, firewood. Let me see how much I want to read. So before we get to that one, there's this one. When you ride in a boat, ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and essence are permanent. When you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has an unchanging self. I know I've had the experience of being in a canoe going down a river with the current and looking down at the river, and it's, you may be going the exact same speed of the river, and when you look down, it looks like you're sitting still because, you know, you're being carried by the river, and then you look over at the shore and the shore is going by. So it can be very strange experience. It makes me think of this a little bit, where Dogen is saying that you may have one impression about what's moving, but it's not how we think. So get my spot back again. Essentially, he's saying that you may have the notion that mind is permanent, or mind in essence is permanent, with this example. So normally we think that we're the boat, or it seems like we're the boat that's permanent and things are moving around us, basically. But he's saying that it's not according to that. We may have this notion that mind is permanent. And to think about permanent self, I don't think many of us have really thought about it too closely. It's sort of like you hear these different examples of being a baby and we're who we are now, which is clearly not the same person. And then, so how do you find kind of this feeling that we have of self? And just in preparing for the talk here, I was kind of trying to think what that is. It's one sort of compelling thing. It seems like the notions are kind of just a worldview is very tied into what we think self is. And maybe you could change sort of year to year or something like that, but kind of there's this essence that's remaining in terms of it's sort of just a worldview or something like that. And Dogen says here, when you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. So practice right where you are. Dilgan's giving us this way to try to resolve the confusion that we have about permanent self. And what he suggests here is just to return where you are. Return to where you are. And that's, I think, why we use breath in meditation, because that is just the most simplified way of being where we are. Because if we start to think about where we are or anything like that, we can get off track. So breath is great. You know, this breath is just right here. It's practice intimately, as Dogen says. So it's, you know, like looking at a sunset, there's this intimacy. It's just the sunset. We may want to take a picture of it or something like that. We may kind of want to capture it, or we start to think about how beautiful it is. But what we're talking about is that intimacy, just returning to where we are. And again, in meditation, we just return to the breath, continue to return to the breath. And maybe I'll read this next paragraph just to give us an intro into it, and then we can talk about it a little bit next time. This is, again, well, this is kind of one of the more famous ones, but I'll go ahead and read it here. Dogen says, firewood becomes ash. It does not become firewood again. Yet, do not suppose that ash is after and firewood is before. Understand that firewood abides in its condition as firewood, which fully includes before and after, while it is independent of before and after. Ash abides in its condition as ash as well, which fully includes before and after. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. So this is, when we hear something like this, about firewood, including before and after, and independent of before and after, it's hard to know exactly how to describe a writing like this. It may sound kind of, sort of maybe poetic or mysterious sounding. I think maybe mysterious would be, one way that it would strike a lot of people, but what the case is, in my experience, as I continue to read teachings of Dharma, is that this is, when you read something like this, you're actually much closer than, say, any scientific explanation of reality that you could ever come across. It seems mysterious, but there's an argument to be made that this is getting you much closer to understanding what is happening, which, you know, it's like, and I'm not saying that what's happening is mysterious. It's just like what's happening in this writing is a softening of our insistence of thinking very categorically, putting things in their boxes, again, framing things up, assuming that our ideas and our views accurately reflect what's happening. So this is pointing, again, back to experience itself, which is obviously what Dogen is talking about in terms of practice, you know, just experience. So we can look at some of the details, I think, tomorrow. And I'm not sure if any questions come up at all. This is hard to, I think maybe for questions to arise because Dogen's, there's such movement going on here that you can't really land on anything. But I don't know if anybody has any recollections of reading it or anything that's come up at all so far. We're about halfway through. Yeah, Andrew.
Can you just reread again one more time the firewood ash portion?
Sure, yeah. Let's see here. Firewood becomes ash. It does not become firewood again. So I think, like everybody, I'm good with that. This is where it goes off the rails. Yet do not suppose that ash is after and firewood is before. Understand that firewood abides in its condition as firewood, which fully includes before and after, while it is independent of before and after. Ash abides in its condition as ash, which fully includes before and after. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. And, yeah, I think that's enough. There's a little extra part of that, but.
I guess the thing that kind of popped up in my head when I first heard you say that was like, you know, it's easy to think about two states, A and B.
Mm-hmm.
And then the transition between those states, though, is like a bazillion things. So it's like your firewood. Firewood came up based on a bazillion things. And then something happens in the moment which starts the firewood to like shift. And then you kind of fall into this whole realm of a million things happening, you know, like slightly ignited wood, a little bit brighter firewood, you know, engulfed firewood. And then, mm-hmm. and then you keep going and then it's like...
It's transfixing too when you look at the fire and like the whooshes of... like embers. I love that. Yeah.
So there's this whole life between A and B. So is that kind of where you think he's going with like it's both independent and yet it includes both sides, if you will? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm saying it correctly. It's hard to say.
yeah, for sure.
It's still good.
I think Dogen has a beautiful way of not creating any type of impression of denigrating the relative world. So as you're saying, the both aspect there of recognizing that what's showing up not only in those transitional, seemingly transitional periods, but then also the life of that piece of firewood too, is that what we have is this incalculable field of conditions. So not only including time, but also being independent from it, and also including all other things, but then also being independent of other things.
That independent part is a tough one for me to put my finger on.
Yeah.
You know.
Because I think often the impression is that, we'll hear the Anatta doctrine and we'll just have a firm idea that, like, grab a hold of the teachings basically and say it's not independent. It's not independent. It has to be interconnected. But that's how Dogen has a pretty radical way of not denigrating how things show up as independent. And not to, so we're giving full respect to the firewood and not abusing it, you know. So we're respecting that, how the relative world shows up. 'Cause we can get off track if we just say everything's interdependent. That's just one way, that's basically when you look at things, there's a teaching of dependent arising, which shows that it is this vast, incalculable field of conditions to the point of you can't even name precisely what those conditions are, because it's everything is self-reflecting on everything else.
Like that middle part between the fire and the ash.
Yeah, you can't find that. So, but if we say everything's like that, it's all conditions, then we're just back into another idea. So I think Dogen has this ability to bring in time, also independence from time. He can talk about something being its itself. You know, you think about how we really get in trouble by not honoring how something is showing up or acting inappropriately to a certain thing. And so Dogen's saying we can hold all these, or we can recognize all these different facets of both, as he says here, including before and after, and independent of before and after. And actually the way to fully respect how things show up, and thus actually creating less harm and actually realizing how they actually are showing up, is to be able to see this and recognize that this is actually more accurate than any way that we could sort of frame it up in some other way. I don't know if I quite get to what you are talking about. Some of my notes sort of get to what you're talking about too. Some of my notes get a little bit to what you're talking to, so I could talk about it at the beginning and then next talk too. But
maybe I can solidify my question better.
Yeah, it's tricky. At least that's what I feel in Dogen, is he has this ability to talk about tiles and pebbles and trees, and it emanates this the true quality of ultimate reality in those things, which actually for me is like also embodies the respect for those things. Not to say that like, oh, they're nothing or they're empty, you know, just like everything's a big oneness or something like that. It's still recognizing and treating appropriate the things to show up.
To use that firework example one more time, it's like to get to A to B, that screen between those things is so volatile, it's so much easier to point at different moments.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, another spark. Oh, this happened.
Exactly.
But then, like, if you just think about A and B, like, imagine the ash is totally died out. All the embers are totally dead. Then it appears to be a very static thing.
Okay, yeah.
And whatever changes are happening so slowly, it seems like it's just a permanent thing. Or like
sure.
A chunk of firewood in my garage, it's been there since last summer, and it hasn't moved, it hasn't changed, you can tell, but it's been totally changing, and I just can't perceive it. You know?
No, yeah, for sure.
It is in the moment. But it feels like that paragraph kind of sets up this repudiation of reincarnation as well. A dialogue would have been happening early on.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely says that very directly.
Yeah. This moment is unique.
Mm-hmm. Which is another...
Before and after.
Emanates respect, too. That all things are unique.
Yeah.
Actually, our thinking presumes like a standard. When we call something a table, all other tables are sort of reference to this standard. And then we sort of almost stereotype things and not recognize complete unique quality of everything beyond standards. So yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, he's refuting ideas, I think, that sort of sprout, confusions that sprout out of Buddhism about reincarnation.
And that old historical thing, I remember from Akamura's translation, that first paragraph, he's got each sentence was a different part of Buddhist history, and here's
oh, really?
Philosophy now kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
I'd have to look again.
Oh, okay, interesting.
But he weaves those things into there.
Yeah, it's fun to have, to watch him give the translation and show the original characters and everything. Yeah. Yeah, Christine.
Just hearing this example harkens back to when you shared with us the different translations, and they seem so paradoxical, but they blend together. Hearing this transition played out or described or understood or thoughtfully kind of being inquired about helps me to put those two different translations together as one, too, because they seem so.
I agree.
Without any kind of example, if it's still here.
Yeah. It's incredible that the language would be able to have characters. Almost, I'm envious of Chinese characters. I think that term, like that term experience, sort of does have that thing too, where you can think of it as the experience or my experience. So, but yeah, I agree with you. Thanks for that. It's that's really the essence of Dogen, that you're seeing. Something that has the potential of being kind of different sides to it, almost like simultaneously in some ways. So I wouldn't, I don't think I'd want to be the person translating this. Like, okay, which one do you land on? Anything else? Yeah, Aaron.
I heard Steve Matuszek, one of the classes,
Matuszek.
Describe the fundamental point as everything. But he just sort of relies on those two. I wonder if he got that from him. I'm not misrepresenting him. That's what I remember, because it really struck me. Because I was familiar with sexualizing the fundamental point in him. And to refer to the fundamental point as everything, you go from kind of visualizing like a pinpoint to suddenly that expanding infinitely in all directions. And that makes me think of some of the, you know, astrophysicists' theories of the beginning of the universe, that the universe supposedly began, you know, small as a pinpoint, so to speak. If you think of that, that's containing everything. You know, that is spatially, you know, impossible in a sense.
Yeah, totally.
And some physicists will describe the universe as expanding infinitely into itself. So it's really bending our ideas of space. And so this is reminding me of that a little bit too.
That's great. Yeah, I appreciate how Steve presented it there. It's and what you mentioned there reminded me of experience. I was at Kitt Peak. It used to be a kind of more prominent observatory for the United States down in Arizona. It's now kind of more of a tourist destination. But I asked one of the scientists there where the center of the universe is. You know, I thought, just like anything else, you know, if something is kind of created, you would have the middle of that big bubble so we could actually point in a direction. And he said it's everywhere. And then I also later heard the example of making dough with raisins in it. So like if you think of all those raisins at one spot, and then it starts as representing the very middle, those that raisin or raisins, and then it expands, you have raisins everywhere. So actually the center is everywhere. Which, some of those images really kind of like help move to a place where we don't need to insist, you know, like a very specific way, or that as you say, the fundamental point where it may seem like just one tiny little spot is actually expressing totality itself. And definitely Dogen's writing contextually if you pick one line out of there, it's like discombobulating because you're trying to like say, okay, he's saying this, but then contextually you have the single point in totality and not having a problem basically with both of those images. That's a beautiful effect of Dogen, is allowing this multifaceted quality to arise and not be disturbed by what seems like contradiction. But thanks for bringing that up. That's a great point, so to speak. No pun intended, I guess. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.